Working Cows Podcast, episode 187.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, here with another episode for you guys, powered by the Global Ag Network. And I am here today, excited for an episode with Justin Frickte and Jared Knock. They are launching or have recently launched a new podcast called Roots and Ruminants. And we are going to talk to them today about the why behind that title for their podcast and kind of their goal for the podcast. They are both guys that work with Milborn Seeds, so opportunity there for some exposure to Milborn Seeds and what they do as well. So I'm excited about more agriculture podcasts, specifically more regenerative agriculture podcasts, that focus on integrating livestock back onto crop ground, and really excited to have a discussion with Justin and Jared today about that. So Justin, Jared, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
You bet. Glad to be here.
This will be fun.
So you guys have recently launched a new podcast called Roots and Ruminants. So I guess kind of I thought we'd use that as an outline for the show today. And where do you want to start? Do you want to start with roots or do you want to start with ruminants?
I think we'll start with roots. And those of you who followed the podcast or seen Milborn Seeds is obviously a large regional and national actually distributor of cover crops, alternative forages, native grass seeds, cool introduced grasses, and pretty much anything else. So, but the roots I think that I guess I'll start with first is kind of where Justin and I are coming from, the perspectives that we have. I grew up by Willow Lake, South Dakota. That was the big town. Carpenter was the little town. Willow Lake's got about 200 people. It's where I went to high school. And I kind of explained that. I got into this a little bit in the last podcast, but, you know, I kind of explained that I grew up in a dying town and going to a dying school and a dying church and a dying 4-H club on a farm that wasn't sure if it was going to be around for another 10 years. And just kind of had this sense of just decay all around us. And I don't mean that to be negative. I really don't. The people that were left were survivors. They were really trying to gut it out there and do the best they could. But just the 1980s and really the 1990s, which was just a hangover from the 80s farm crisis, 20 years had just gotten areas so down that everybody was just wondering whether or not we could survive another year. And so you looked at your school and you said, well, you know, maybe if we can outlast Iroquois or Doland, we'll get a few kids from there, or Henry. And it was kind of developing this survivor mentality. And I don't want to start that off negative, but that's kind of how we grew up. So farrowing out sows, milking 100 cows with my uncles, having a few beef cows, just kind of scratching out a living in a very diversified farm ranch operation. And one that, you know, we really didn't at the time growing up think there might be much future at. In fact, that was kind of the marching orders from my parents was get out of here, get a job. You're not allowed back here right after college. Mm-hmm. So after 5 years of going to school to get a 4-year degree with no major changes and no minors. So that was, kind of me stretching out the good times as long as I could. Had to meet Justin there. I did a lot of the same things, livestock judging, niece judging, different years, and then pursuing a career after that. And then during that career, you know, just happened to work out that Justin and I get to work together on a lot of different projects now. So the roots part of Roots of Ruminants, I'd say for me is understanding, you know, that background to make family farms and ranches viable, make them diverse, make them something that we're just conscious that we can be a part of a viable future is just something that I'm passionate about.
So. Well, I'm just saying, that's a pretty good segue we're opening into talking about our podcast is the roots of our foundation is kind of why we wanted to talk about or why we wanted to host this podcast. And our upbringings were really, really similar. Jared talked about the diversity of his operation or the farm that he grew up on is real similar to the diversity of the operation that I grew up in. I grew up northwest of Pipestone, about 15 miles, but we had sheep and rinstock cows and corn, soybean, small grain, and forage operation. And then, dad later built the hog barn, custom feeding nursery barn, to bring in some supplemental income to the farm as well. I think it's a bit rare to have farms now that diverse. But as we bring in people that we want to talk to on Roots and Ruminants podcast, they have that diversity factor. Maybe it's not with multiple species or multiple crops on their operation. A lot of times it will be, but the diversity of how they're looking at things and how they're handling things on their farm and ranches, that's the mindset that we really appreciate, and the mindset of how we want to be able to look at ranching and farming going forward for the future is this big, wide scope of making sure that we're seeing everything with a wide lens and keeping that diversity and so that we're staying profitable. And, the deeper part of that is what Jared just mentioned is, golly, we really do care about the upper Midwest and the communities that we're a part of. And that means something to us. And we want to raise families here. So that's all really, really important.
Yeah. Justin, could you kind of lay out for me what diversity looks like in your mind when you're talking about diversity in an operation? What are some of the hallmarks or defining characteristics of a diverse operation?
I think diversity means tying your systems together so that there isn't waste. And, that means stacking enterprises so that we have we're utilizing assets to the best of their abilities, right? If we're going to have if we're going to have equipment, let's make sure that we're spreading that cost of the equipment over crop and livestock operations and across different species lines. If we do happen to run a feed wagon, well, let's make sure that we're not just feeding the stock cows with it 1 month out of the year. You know, how do we then maybe keep back owners, or maybe we have another species, maybe we have some sheep that we're then gonna cheapen up a ration with and feed them with a feed wagon. I think it's all those things that I think it's diversifying within your operation to cut costs, so that we're always making sure that this is it's a holistic approach to ranching or a holistic approach to farming. Diversity is a big part of that because it's all got to fit into that same circle.
I have been saying since I started my podcast that we needed more agricultural podcasts. If I had my preferences, my druthers, I would say we need more cow-focused regenerative agriculture podcasts, if I could be so niche, I guess, because there's the guys that are consuming this content, the guys and gals that are consuming this content, that I'm producing, that you guys are producing, have more time to consume content than I have to produce enough content for them to consume. And so I posted a meme the other day. I like memes. I like making memes. I like looking at memes. I posted a meme the other day, and it's the Buzz and Woody meme from Toy Story. I've got four kids, so I tend to gravitate towards those kind of memes. And it's the one where Buzz is saying, whatever, whatever, everywhere. And I said, new podcasts everywhere. And so one of those new podcasts, along with yours, in the last 2 months, I think, we've had Ranching Reboot with Brian Alexander from Kansas. We've had the Herd Quitter podcast with Jared Lumen from Minnesota, and then you guys are coming online as well. And all of them kind of fit that description of maybe you guys are a little bit more broad than just cow focused, but it is ruminant focused and regenerative, mm-hmm. I would say. And I was listening to Brian Alexander's interview the other day on the Ranching Reboot podcast, and he was talking to Mike Calicrate, and Mike was talking about right down to composting hides from slaughtered animals, composting the guts from slaughtered animals, and putting that back out on the field. So I think, making those integrated holes and managing those as much as we can is a huge thing, and I think it's part of the reason there are so many new podcasts coming online in these sectors is because there's demand for it. And I think part of the reason there's demand for it is because people have a desire to be in agriculture, but
you know, as I heard Jared share at the Young Farmers and Ranchers conference a couple of years ago, you know, I think he said his grandpa had seen a 1,000x increase in land values from when he bought his land to you know, just in the recent past. And so that's kind of a tough hill to sled, getting started with that kind of an increase in land where we're not going to have that kind of an increase probably, and getting started there. So getting the soil as healthy as it can, I think is one key to getting started in the climate that we're in right now. And so if you would, Jared, share a little bit about what the root side of roots and ruminants looks like. What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to manage for when you start talking about managing healthy soil and healthy roots?
Sure. No, great question. I think that there was a fundamental shift when they added the fifth tenet of soil health, right? When Ray Archuleta almost single-handedly got NRCS to basically announce there was a fifth tenet of soil health, not just the first four that primarily deal more with the crop side of things. Even though help, you know, native rangeland and improved pasture even accomplishes all four of the first tenets of soil health. And I want to make that very clear. But the incorporation of livestock as something that needs to be done in every healthy system. And it is not in some healthy systems, or it's not if they're just you know, feed focused. I think the reality is that in the state of South Dakota, really in the Midwest, we primarily produce livestock feed. We have some ethanol, we have some soybean oil, we have some milling wheat, and some sunflowers. Other than that, you know, predominantly most of our corn is going towards livestock, even after it's gone through the ethanol process. Most of soybean meal, straw, hay. So our system is highly designed around feeding animals. And I think that the default position is to pen the animals and feed them there. I think there's a lot of creativity on ways to feed animals that don't involve the extra step of fossil fuel use. I think there's better ways to harvest that on the land. Anytime we can extend grazing periods and grazing seasons, I think it's to everyone's benefit. And everyone, I'm saying, much broader than, you know, society, really, their benefit as well. So I think that there's just an understanding that regardless of the commodities that we think we're producing, for the most part, the revenue coming into our, even if just farmer only, the revenue coming into our operations is primarily supporting livestock.
And your episode one with James Holes was really good in that regard, about a different way to approach getting those animals fed and the marketing, the sourcing, all of it was out of the box. I really enjoyed it. You guys are doing a great job with that, and I really appreciate it. I'm glad to see more podcasts coming online. And that fifth principle that you're talking about, adding livestock integration back into the land, is, you know, something that when my travels with the Young Farmers and Ranchers Committee for Farm Bureau takes me east, I see, you know, the fields that don't have a fence around them, and I'm like, well, there's obviously not livestock integration happening there. What are some of the objections, Justin, as you understand it? What are some of the barriers to livestock integration as you understand it?
So like I said, I grew up in Northwest Minnesota, Northwest of Pipestone, and live there currently now. And so we travel across Minnesota for high school sports and everything. And you get out of the southwest corner, and it's a completely different world. I mean, I-90 drive east across Minnesota. There isn't a fence. There isn't a fence line on any of those fields. They're completely gone. They're all worked, obviously. A lot of them are still plowed when you go north of there. I mean, maybe the question to answer there is, what happened there? Why did the livestock leave? And what can we learn from that, I guess? Obviously, if we're going to make sure that these operations stay diverse, I think it probably comes back to a bigger discussion of profiting from raising livestock and the opportunities that it can bring financially. You know, I mean, right now we're turning again in a different cycle as far as commodities and what they look like. And, you know, go ask somebody from South Central Minnesota who hasn't had cattle for 25 years, but is who is really excited about soil health, the likelihood of them getting cattle back in their operation now is probably pretty slim. And I guess the easiest thing to do for them is to continue to farm with ease because of technology and equipment and less manual labor. And if you have livestock, you have more manual labor, you have more time. It's just harder. And it's not going to be as profitable as farming corn and soybeans in the next year, at least. So it's not really a good sell. So I guess they had to comment that.
I always say I'm row crop illiterate, so you can tell me if I'm dumb or whatever. I won't be offended. But, you know, it seems to me that there's an opportunity. There's an opportunity there for some enterprising young agriculturalist to go out there and offer to those guys, hey, I'll put up the fence. I'll work on the water infrastructure. I'll bring the cattle. I'll source the cattle. I'll make sure that they're there when they should be and gone when they should be. You know, it seems like, you know, all of these row crop, you know, you talk about the I states, all of these row crop areas in the world, there is an opportunity there for somebody to provide, you know, kind of ecosystem services and bring in the ruminants to help the roots. You know, am I way off? Are people totally opposed to that idea if somebody's willing to do the work? I don't know. You guys tell me what do you think? Is that a viable option and business model?
Well, I certainly love the idea of it. Absolutely love it. And I think that's probably a great entry point for somebody who wants to have livestock, because there's a big resource that's not being utilized to its full advantage with the land there, you know, and certainly can bring some benefits to that landowner as far as soil quality goes too. So are those people open to it? I would say there is at least a portion that is open to it, and that's, you know, at least it's somebody. And I do believe that that's true. I really do. I also believe that there's a large portion that's not even. I'm not trying to be cynical or negative. It's just the way it is. But yeah, there's definitely a sector out there that, you know, maybe their kids have no interest back in agriculture, even if it is just farming, and they want somebody to take care of, you know, their land and their legacy. Boy, that's a big opportunity for somebody who maybe doesn't have that in their life. That really does exist. So I guess that's a good challenge, you know, for both the young people and the, you know, the farmers that have that resource and have it available to at least try to keep that going.
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult to get in, right?
So
from stocker operation in the I states, you know, the idea that you're going to be able to get, you know, capital for a couple hundred head to start with is difficult. So it's most of these things we see starting on small scale and then scaling as they get comfortable and successful at what they do. And there's really just not a good replacement of that. That's probably actually a better long-term strategy than saying, I'm going to go from never having seen a cow in this, or a steer or a calf on this property, to go buying 500 head of stockers to put on, you know, corn stocks this fall without ever having taken care of one successfully first, right? So the problem is that we need a lot of small-scale innovation to start with, and then it can be scaled once the knowledge and expertise is built up.
Yeah, and like I said, I think my vision for that kind of a thing is more ecosystem services, where I don't own the cows and I don't own the land. You know, I am simply a middleman and the manager. You know, if it yeah. grew enough, you could just be the middleman and then you would hire other managers. You know, but I'm the middleman and the manager to start with, where I'm finding people who need winter feed for their cattle, and I'm finding guys who've got corn stalks that I can turn these cattle out on, and then I'm showing up and I'm moving those cattle every day or every 3 days, whatever it is. And I guess, is that model enough to answer the compaction question, because when I've pitched that idea to different friends of mine who are row crop guys, which tends to be just guys on the YF&R committee, that's the response I get, is the compaction issues. So if you're moving them every 3 days to a fresh set of corn stalks, you know, strip grazing away from water or whatever, is that enough to deal with compaction? Is that going to make compaction worse? Again, confessing my row crop ignorance here, go ahead and fire away. But would that work?
You know, University of Nebraska has done quite a few studies over the years on this, on just showing that there's no negative impact on crop yield from corn stalk grazing, especially when rotated. They will find that in really wet falls, right, when you get a lot of pugging and you can have some activity like that. Well, you know, in a system where the corn stalks are within a mile of your place, you can manage that. You can pull off, you can adjust, right, the stored feed supplies, that kind of thing. It makes it difficult if you're trying to operate 70 to 100 miles away or something like that, or you're a long ways away from the corral. But that would be the only issues. I think that the dollars just have to get more attractive. I mean, even the $8 to $10 or $10 to $15 an acre, you know, $8 to $15, $5 to $15 is kind of the range you hear about corn stalks being rented for. In 5 bushel, $5 corn territory, that's 2 to 3 bushels. In a year where row crop farmers have gotten $20 an acre for every acre of corn they had in different seed maps, right? I mean, the difference has to be appreciable, right? We've got to be hungry in order to change.
Yeah.
Got to be hungry. Mm. And the question is, are they hungry enough? The science, I think, is fairly well supportive of that. The old knowledge of what we think about soil compaction, the reason we're doing, you know, the level of tillage and stuff that we still are, is going to be hard to change. Science is fairly supportive of that, but yeah, I'm not sure that there's going to be a hungriness to take it on.
Well, that's the thing. You see, there's just so much fall tillage that happens. I think that's probably the battle that needs to be won before allowing the corn stalks to graze, is they just have to stop doing fall tillage. So whether that comes from research, science, some sort of funding program that doesn't, or that does pay them or does penalize them, which shouldn't penalize none of them. That's where all the word needs to start.
Yeah. You know, I think the hunger is going to come, or the hunger probably comes from the guy who wants to be an agriculturalist but can't afford $7,000 an acre land, you know.
Yeah.
And that hunger comes from him, you know, cold calling, knocking on doors, you know, and saying, hey, when you're done harvesting, will you leave those corn stalks there for me to bring some cows if I'm willing to do the fence and water infrastructure work? And, you know, I think that's where the hunger is going to come from. And if you walk in there with a folder and some, you know, a presentation, that's well put together and a proposal that says, these are the benefits as far as, soil health, this is the manure and urine distribution and the difference it's going to make, you know, in the aggregation of your soil. You know, that's kind of where I'm thinking it's got to come from that side, because I agree with you. Corn, soybeans, Florida is an attractive rotation. I'm just, you know, I get that.
Yeah, we understand that too. And so we're saying that this is literally about the short-term gain. It's not about the short-term gain. It's about manifesting values, creating diverse pathways and systems, and expressing ourselves in the way that we so see fit and can make work. And it might not be the highest profit potential in the next 3 months, but it's a system that we won't have to change drastically if the outcome of plan A changes, right? So if corn goes back down to $3, we don't have to drastically change our game plan because we've got a robust system with multiple pathways. And yeah, exactly.
That's right on. And Clay, you mentioned, you know, it's really good of that person that is hungry and is willing to go after it, put some effort and time to do it. You tie that into that diverse mindset of that, you know, young farmer or rancher that wants it bad enough. And that just, I mean, that's exactly why we're here doing and talking about what we're talking about.
I remember reading in Knowledge Rich Ranch in my own nation, this was 20 years ago probably, but the idea for the first time where in South Dakota, especially like East Central South Dakota, probably has as high of annual pasture rent as anywhere in to North America for sure, right? So, and the reason is because we're productive enough where we generally have grass all the time, and we don't have to invest on a periodic basis in brush control, right? And we aren't constantly being invaded by woody species that are trying to take over, which is why pasture in the south and east, even though they get more rain, is more expensive because it has more maintenance cost, okay? So the idea that we have this in the reading and knowledge ranching about guys down in Mississippi getting paid, not paying, getting paid to graze down the vegetation on the dikes, berms, and things like that. This is like, yeah, okay, you can get paid to graze. We know an example of a group in Minnesota that gets paid to run sheep on solar farms, right, to keep vegetation down. So they're getting paid to graze, not paying to graze. And I think that's where, ultimately, if the incentive structure was there and if we fully understood the societal benefits of everything of grazing and the ground agronomic benefits of grazing corn stalks with cows instead of doing tillage to manage residue, we would be paid to graze. But we're not there today. We're still paying to graze. We're not paying a lot, but we're paying to graze.
That's rough. Somebody calls you up, offers you a brand of cows and pay you $25 a head to bring them home. Oh, fine. Yeah, sure. I could bring them for a few bucks.
Yeah.
Who's the best audience for this conversation? Is it college students who want to be involved? Who would you think are the people who need to be made aware of the opportunity if somebody was hungry enough to pursue it?
I think this is a great opportunity for someone to do in their hometown if the resources allow. I think you'd have an uphill battle. You'd probably be kind of viewed as one of the door-to-door people that come by and want to paint your galvanized roads in your bins. You know what I mean? If you've got 300 miles away from home with a folder and you're 22 years old and you have a pitch for somebody, you know, is this how it's going to be received? So, but I think it's great if you have the ability to have some, and you don't have to do it in your hometown, but get somewhere and plant and get to where people trust you. Don't be discouraged if you go knock on doors where no one knows who you are and has never heard of you before, and they say no to this. That's pretty common nature, right? I probably wouldn't, allow someone to come babysit if they, I'd never heard of them before and they're knocking on my door and they want to, watch my house for me. I'm probably not going to allow someone like that to run, watch down, and deal with my property either. So in a place where you can build up or have those connections, I think it's a great opportunity. I think what has happened is, this is less, you go to the east, but in large sections of the areas, I think that there, if your farming operation wasn't of a certain size, you didn't come back because, it wasn't full-time. In reality, this hybrid of extra income as well as being able to grow and maintain maybe a less than full-time existence on a farm or ranch now is a pathway that's been common and probably going to become more common in the future. So this would be, it doesn't always have to be employment. And I think that's where we messed up. We've got to have to be a job. It doesn't have to be a job. It just has to be a supplemental source of income. And that can definitely be running your own business.
Yeah. And this is something, I've considered, I've got a son who's 12 years old, and right now I'm still trying to talk my wife into letting him live in a camper on my dad's irrigated farm ground. when he's 15, 16 years old during the summers. Cause I mean, there's an opportunity there. You could go and get some experience grazing animals, on some irrigated ground. And, I think it's something that given the nature of the tools for, grazing right now, a 15, 16 year old kid could build the fence, by himself, start out, with some fiberglass rods and some high tensile wire, and he could do the work. And so I think that there's opportunity even before graduation from high school to in the summer to get some of these experiences and build up some of those skills and then maybe use that as an opportunity to facilitate the growth of a business like that. What else, what are some of your other goals, with the Roots and Ruminants podcast? Tell me about some of the upcoming guests or people that you guys are looking to feature.
So I think one of the other really cool things that we're going to touch on with, a lot of the different people that come on the show is their different forage systems. Everybody needs to make feed for at least some portion of the year to feed their livestock. And it's getting those stories told of the unique ways that people are working them into crop rotations. There's just so many different variables and different options. But, you know, when it's working in a PO blend for baleage or silage or incorporating teff grass, or maybe you get hail down on your corn crop and now we're going to broadcast a cover crop to graze. And like, we've got the opportunity to hear all these stories and see the cool systems people have made and made them work for the soil, for their livestock, and made it work, you know, from a dollars and cents perspective. And so those are the stories we want told, because that's what everybody's hungry for too, I think, is they want to hear the real life stories. How did it really work for the guy? And can I just talk to him? Can I just hear his story? That's what we want to do, I guess. And that's kind of what we've done. Jared and I have done a lot of that within our own operations. And those are the ways that you're trying to save money, you know, from buying less feed or incorporating the cheaper feed stuff. And so you start there, and then you figure out that holy bucket. So maybe this actually does mean good things for my soil. And then you see that side of it, and you become, you know, you dive into the soil health side and you see all those benefits and you get excited about that and the return and just the good things that are coming from that. Once again, that whole systems approach and it's farms out there. So yeah, we've got more of that coming, I guess, on the podcast. But that's what we're comfortable with and what we like to talk about.
Yeah, I think it's about, like I said, turning that survivor mentality into, you know, something that you're proud of and building towards. And creating resiliency. And the more we can share ideas and have other people on this podcast share ideas about that, the happier I'll be. Because I don't live in that, you know, description of the town that I described earlier. You know, I'll tell you, there's a lot of things that turn back around. We've got an entire few generations back if we're talking about, you know, that dying town of Willow Lake that I was growing up in, that dying school now has 50% more enrollment than it did 10 years ago, right? So there's positive stories that are happening. Primarily happening because of a large influx of young people, and with that has become a lot more livestock. And it's a little everything. It's cattle, sheep, and hogs, and dairy animals, and all of the above in the area. That's what's been working. So there's 1,000-ish species of plants that have, you know, seeds of 1,000 species in the Millboard warehouse pretty much at any given time. It's just an unlimited amount of combinations of mixes and, you know, between native grass reseedings to cover crops to forages that can be put together. And we just want to help share some of those ideas and think creatively on how to apply those.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that Clark Willow Lake is a perennial contender for the wrestling team trophy. they're doing good things there with the wrestling team. So
championship a couple years back. And yeah, they're doing well in a lot of ways, but it's a stark turnaround, and I think it was a little bit of attitude and ideology, and it was a lot of opportunities that came from livestock.
So, you know, you talked a little bit about growing up in the mid-90s or so and kind of having that hangover from the 80s and seeing a lot of those kind of withering on the vine operations in towns, and now you talk about kind of the turnaround that you're seeing there. Are they marketing those animals that came back in with the younger generations? Are they marketing them the same way they were marketed in the 80s, or are they approaching the marketing of those animals differently now than they were back then?
Certainly the hogs completely left, and then now they're kind of back in confinement and contract form, which provides some good opportunities. It provides at least we're at a circular system of nutrient flow at that point, right? So the hogs are getting raised and they're getting fed our corn and soybeans no matter what. The closer that we can have them, the more that we can cycle the nutrients back in the land, the better it is. And so that's the one thing we want to be careful of, that we're not taking any system down or, you know, belittling any system in agriculture. There's varying, you know, degrees of what that looks like to be diverse, resilient, and that kind of stuff. So that's a big step. That's a real positive step that we now are actually feeding that feed closer to home and recycling. back on our land, even though those are in a barn, right? So that has changed.
Yeah.
Like I said, the hogs much all left. They were gone for a decade or two. Now they're coming back, right? So that's a positive thing. The dairy cattle, same way. We're the last people to milk cows in Southern Clark County independently in 2000, you know, dad and two uncles. And then we had one dairy move in about 10 years ago or so. And then now we have tens of thousands moving, right? And so the feed resources, the feed needs are changing, everything like that. The cow-calf structure has intensified, and they pretty much get marketed the same way. So, and the sheep numbers actually yep. up exponentially in the area as well. So the sheep cattle segment has not probably changed appreciably on how they've marketed their products, who they sell to, who ends up feeding them, how they get to the consumer. The dairy is, you know, spent 20 years absent from the area, now is back and is pretty much in a consolidated form. And the hogs, you know, the hog industry isn't changing. It changed. And, you know, you could still get multiple options for barn spaces in most times. So you can build a barn and you can kind of pick who your partner is. There doesn't seem to be a lot more further consolidation than where they're at now. So I think you still have some options on people to work with in the future. So I guess that's maybe a long answer, but that's explaining the state of what most livestock looks like.
I was just saying, like, on the cattle side of it, if we look at how people are raising them, it definitely has intensified in terms of management and care and that sort of thing. But in terms of how they are marketed, yeah, maybe people still take them to the same sale barn or going through the same buying group. But if you look at how they're being marketed and sold to the consumer, I think that's where we've seen the biggest change in the last 10 years. You know, I mean, we didn't have CAB, we didn't have certified perfect beef, we didn't have grass-fed, we didn't have organic, we didn't have NHTC, calves, like all these different programs that are now built in to what the consumer is actually demanding is driving how we're doing it. And so I think that, I mean, once again, it's another opportunity for us. Pick your favorite program and work it and go for it and try to make the best. But that's probably, and I think, I guess, looking towards the future and how we're raising beef and how we're operating within our cow-calf operations, it's probably going to be more of that. And it's probably going to consolidate and get even tighter into those groups where, all right, I'm tied into a 5-year contract now with a buying group that wants them raised this way. You know, I mean, maybe it's just not hormone treated. Maybe it's all natural, not antibiotics. This is my buying group, and I can see that, you know, 50 other producers that are doing it, and now we are marketing our product together to have, you know, more selling power. I see that that's how the consumer wants to purchase, and we're probably going to have to produce it that way for them.
It's good to have that feedback loop. Jared, you talked about nutrient cycling, and I'm hesitant to mention the name because I still can't believe, you know, I believe what he said. I just can't believe that I understood him correctly. And I was on a farm tour in eastern South Dakota, and we were touring a concentrated animal feeding operation, and I was talking to the dad in this scenario, and he told me about the difference applying the manure, you know, from the CAFO back out on their fields has made, and basically it pays his son's salary for the year what they save in you know, chemical fertilizer and those kinds of costs every year is paying his son's salary to basically be the labor side of the feedlot and the farming operation. So, I mean, it's just pretty incredible when you start to think about what you can accomplish through nutrient cycling.
Yeah, no, they must be getting a little bit better rates on manure application than we are. manure application can be quite a high expense when you factor that in there. Really everything, wear and tear on machines. If you hire a gun, you realize that it's quite expensive but it's really important that you don't have those nutrients leave. So was working with a guy and we were talking about some challenges he's having in his soils, and we were doing some testing, but he's likely just phosphorus deficient, and he's trying to, you know, kind of cover crop his way out of a phosphorus deficiency. And there's just no way to do that, right? It's if you used your soil taking forage off or grain off or whatever it was, and you got yourself in a phosphorus deficiency, you just don't have a choice but to go to a mine and get phosphorus and put it in your soil, So that nutrient cycling is really important so that you don't have to continually go back to the well, to the few places that have phosphorus wells in the United States and continue to buy them.
I guess I got a couple of questions here that came in from my private Facebook group that I wanted to play for you guys to answer. But before we get to that, I'll get my own question answered. How do you guys approach seeds and planting in a range scenario? I'm in some very heavy clay soils where I'm at, predominantly dominated by crested wheat. Is it just graze it until it improves? Is there a good way to go about preparing that land to receive seed? How would you guys approach that scenario?
Well, I think the easiest and the cheapest is through management, and I actually believe that most native range land, or even if it's not still native, but range land that was restored will still get to the point you want it to through really good management. But I believe that you can speed that up by doing some interseeding things. And usually we see the best results when we're interseeding a diversity of species that offsets what's there. So when we're in really a ratio of lots of grasses with very little broadleaves and legumes on the land, it's always easier to establish legumes in amongst them. And overseeding legumes that are, or broadleaves or forbs that are naturally shade tolerant and can live with the competitiveness of the grasses out there, they take hold and do well. So I guess, start to finish, how I would go about it is making sure that we're putting suitable forbs and legumes out there for your soils and your area and your climate. If it's going back on native rangeland, then we'll use good forage quality legumes, prairie clover and lead plant, things that cattle still like a lot. And then we'd probably go out there. Most cases, we'd actually broadcast it because it is just, in most areas, so hard to go out there with a no-till drill and overseeding. So then we'd probably do frost seedings and either do that as a dormant seeding in December time or in March, try to catch that freeze-thaw cycle with some snow coming on it too. So that's kind of how I'd go about it. Try through management, but if it's a long road, uphill battle that we want to speed up, then we do some interseedings with some suitable species out there.
I appreciate that. So first question comes from a dairy producer out of Manitoba, Canada.
Hi, Clay. This is Sean Smith from Manitoba calling. I had a question for Justin in your next interview. I was just curious if he has ever planted multi-species crops for animal feed. I've been thinking about doing this on our dairy, and I was just wondering if he had any experience on it, thinking something like barley, peas, and maybe flax and something else, toss into it, combine it, and put it all through a hammer mill and use it as animal feed. If you could get that question to him, that'd be great. Thank you.
I guess I'll let Justin weigh on this too, but the biggest challenge of trying to harvest, like grain harvest, multiple species at one time is because they just many times don't achieve maturity. So you'll get the barley, over mature where it's starting to shell out, and the peas still green yet, and the flax not where it needs to be. Tremendous luck with mixing species when it comes to making forage, right? Putting it into a bale, putting it into a windrow, putting it into a silo, a pile. But when it comes to, combining, heard some success with a few things, but mostly it's like two species things that are kind of getting raised together. And I think that you're probably still going to have a little bit of loss when it comes to, getting them just right, mature at the right time.
Yeah, I guess that's what I've seen too. It is tricky, but it can be done. You're either going to have shadow loss or you're going to have loss on the combine. And I guess if your mindset is such that you're okay with some of that and you just want that diverse grain blend, it is doable. And Jared mentioned a few species, and you did too, Clay, that do work. Yeah, we've had decent luck with the cereal grains because their maturity is fairly similar. And so like the pea, barley, triticale, oat, those have worked fairly good. And they're all tall, and we can get them all in. Well, I guess if you laid it down on the mineral and came up to pick up that, it's doable with anything. But if you're a straight combine, you want them all the same height too. But the seed size of those species are similar and maturity is similar, and so we're actually able to combine and take them for grain and have a pretty uniform full of grain and combine model for them.
And the next one's up from a former guest of yours.
This is Luke Perman, and we run a corn, soybean, and wheat rotation on our annual crop ground, but we would like to include a perennial crop, something like a 3 to 5 year duration in our rotation. I was curious what you might suggest, how that might look in that rotation when you would plant it, and just kind of some tips for managing some perennials in a shorter part of the rotation. Thanks.
Well, if I was going to do a perennial that's going to last 3 to 5 years, I mean, I guess the thing that's going to be the most productive is probably going to be a blend of alfalfa and grasses. And I think that probably fits in the most, it's the broadest in terms of fitting everybody's goals, you know, across a wide array of different operations. And so depending on where you are now, the grasses I would choose, when we move west, we tend to use more wheat grasses. Intermediate pubescent wheatgrass work well with alfalfa and fit into a two-cut system quite decent. And when we move east, we like orchard grass, meadow fescue, tall horse fescue, timothy. Those would be higher quality grasses that persist even better. And so with higher amounts of rainfall as the alfalfa tends to regrow faster with higher moisture longer growing seasons, those do too. And so on the 3-4 cut alfalfa system, those grasses can still work in conjunction with alfalfa. I just, anytime that I can get a grass and alfalfa, I'm all for it. I think it feeds better than straight alfalfa. I think the longevity is better with those stands, and I think it's good from a diversity standpoint. That always does for a 5-year rotation quite nicely, actually.
And I would say that if you were looking at doing just grazing, it's pretty much the same species. You don't really have time to get the value out of a lot of those, you know, more traditional native warm season grasses that are iconic. Just take too long to establish, the more expensive to seed, probably aren't worth it in a 5-year, you know, duration. And the problem with putting an annual cover crop out 5 years in a row with the first cover crop mix is going to be weed control.
Yeah.
You know, it just, it's great to have a 10 species, 8 species mix out there for grazing, but you want to have some good weed control ahead of it, and then you're going to want to have something with it afterwards. So, you know, you could say, I like the idea of a 5-year perennial. If you wanted to do 3 years, I maybe probably wouldn't go to a perennial. I would do that. I'd do a diverse cover crop mix and then like a sedan grass, BMR sedan grass straight, so that you can put some broadleaf weed control the next year, and then the year after that, try and go back to a diverse cover crop mix, graze those. Pretty, you know, standard, obviously 3 days on, 45 days rest, trying to rotate as much as you can. And I think that traditionally pasture has been one of our rotations, and we haven't really thought about it in a few decades, maybe a generation, but a lot of fields in Iowa or Minnesota were the sow pastures, right? We're at 40 acres where you planted up to something and put the sows out there, or clover, where the dry cows went, the dairy cows were. So it hasn't been all that many years where fields didn't get some sort of a perennial, you know, planted back to it for a period of time to try and, you know, be able to recover some soil structure, hold the ground together, do some different things into the soil, build some organic matter back. And I think we've maybe talked about it in one of the podcasts here, but maybe that's a solution to, you know, 30 years of cropping, 15 years of perennial pasture for some of these marginal acres, if they're going to stay into crop production. It might have to be an ongoing refreshing to try and, you know, keep things together. So.
But as you said in your podcast with James Holtz, be careful because perennials are a gateway drug, I think. Is that what you guys said?
I did. Yeah, you're going to start that. You're not going to be happy. You're going to want natives. You're going to see that first field of, you know, seeding with big blue stem or Indian grass out there, and you're going to fall in love. So.
Well, Justin and Jared, I thank you guys for your time today. Where can people go to find more about the Roots and Ruminants podcast?
Yeah, you can see it in the Millborn Seeds social media accounts, Twitter and Facebook. It should be up there. Otherwise, we're available on pretty much all the major venues, Apple, YouTube, Spotify.
Yeah. Cool. Very good. Thanks, guys, for your time today.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is awesome.
Appreciate it.
Keep up the good work.
Very good stuff there with Justin and Jared. Really excited to see new podcasts getting off the ground. Really looking forward to continued growth in this space and the opportunity for people to continue that continuing education. I keep seeing people posting on social media about how podcasts take those $10 an hour jobs that we find ourselves doing and turn them into more profitable time spent with some of the best minds in the industry in their ears. And that's not just agriculture, but all kinds of different things, you know, audiobooks and different things like that, and that commitment to lifelong learning. So as always, really encourage you to check out workingcows.net/resources. There will be a link in the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/187, to the workingcows.net/resources page. So go ahead and check that out and click through some of those links and go down the rabbit hole of good resources to improve your management of the land, animals, people, and money that are entrusted to your care. We'll be back again real soon with another episode of the Working Cows Podcast. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.